So one dimension is the world of nature, is the world. And there's three dimensions which have to do with human nature that are essential for children to learn the enchantment of. One of those three is the body, the human body. No one decides to have the body they have as a child. In modern culture, you can decide to have a different body with cosmetic surgery and so on. But we don't, which is one of our serious pathologies, but as a child, you don't decide what body you have. And so one of the tasks of stage two is to fall in love with the body you have, which is hard to do in our society. Everybody knows why. If it doesn't look a certain way, it's, you know, you're told you don't have a lovable body. And if you're, you don't get a natural exercise and free play outside, and you're fed fast food, you're going to have a very large body by the time you're 4 or 6 or whatever. Probably everybody knows there's an epidemic of childhood obesity in our society. The numbers are so staggering, I'm not allowed to repeat them. It's quite remarkable. And there's an epidemic of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder because, now we know from the research, it's because children aren't allowed to play outdoors on their own. And when you allow children with ADHD to play outside on their own, their symptoms start decreasing immediately. Isn't that interesting? This is from a wonderful book by Richard Louv called The Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. Nature deficit disorder, people have finally figured it out. It's a very, very serious problem. Richard Louv, L-O-U-V. L-O-U-V. So I'm on the four dimensions of nature in stage two, is the outdoors, so to speak, the world. Second, there's our bodies. And children need to explore their own bodies. And they need parents who don't think there's something wrong with their child who's exploring his or her own body, assuming she or he has not been sexually abused yet. Which doesn't mean she shouldn't still be exploring her body, but she needs some additional help. The third dimension of nature, which are the second one of human nature, is emotions. You know the bumper sticker, emotions happen. They're natural. There's no such thing as a bad emotion. Some esteemed psychotherapists will tell you there are toxic emotions. There are no toxic emotions. And there's no parts of, this came up at breakfast, there's no parts of ourselves we ever want to kill off. Every single part of us is essential to our wholeness, and we need to embrace those parts so they can be healthier. But we don't want to kill any parts off, especially the loyal soldier. You need the loyal soldier, best friend you've ever had. So emotions happen, and children need to learn how to embrace every emotion. And prepubescent children, we need to help them in a different way we help teenagers, because teenagers can do things that children neither can nor need to. But children need to basically be given permission to have all their feelings and to have them in their bodies. And then, after they've had them, their parents need to help them learn what there is to learn from that emotion, because there's something good to learn from every emotion. As opposed to modern psychiatry, I actually read this in the New England Journal of Medicine, refereed journal, highly esteemed medical journal. A psychiatrist several years back wrote an article saying, well, because we're kind of primitive in medicine and psychology, we haven't yet designed all the designer drugs that will keep people from having any of the negative emotions, which are most of them. But we're getting closer, and in a couple decades, we will be able to eliminate all the negative emotions through modern medicine. Hang in there. It wasn't published on April 1st. Okay, the fourth dimension of human nature, my opinion, is the deep imagination. Dreams happen. Daydreaming happens. No one's doing that right now in this room, of course, but daydreaming happens naturally. That's why there's no windows here, so you can't daydream. Dreams happen, active imagination or passive imagination. It happens, and children's imagination needs to be encouraged thoroughly. Their imaginary friends, everybody knows that here, their imaginary Quakers, need to be encouraged. Every child should have an imaginary Quaker. Yeah. Not real ones, but the imagination is one of the ways to know things. We can know things through our imagination that we cannot know any other way. What have we done in our society? We've made one of those splits. Real, imaginary. When imagination is a way, in fact, to find out things. Another split. Truth, myth. Which is a particularly interesting split because myth actually means sacred story. So children's imagination is as important thing as anything, because what childhood is about, I think, is the gift of childhood to the whole community is wonder. And there's a wonderful book by Richard Hyde. Tom, is that his name? Lewis Hyde. Richard Lewis. No Hyde there at all. Richard Lewis, L-E-W-I-S. Yes. Who teaches in New York, and Tom Goodridge can tell you about him because Tom knows him and maybe he's even studying with him. Yes, okay.
What's it called?
His book is called Living by Wonder, and he's a primary school educator, and he's worked for years with little kids. And he knows that their imagination is as important as anything, and encouraging their wonder and their awe of the natural world, otherwise known as the world. So, four dimensions of nature. That's the nature task of stage two. Helping a child immerse themselves in a minimally supervised way in the wild world, their bodies, their emotions, their imagination. And there's some amazingly progressive things happening in education these days. But they tend to be in places like California. Or Maine. Or all over the country now. We're getting some very progressive, eco-literate education for green education, otherwise known as, for children. And forcing them to sit in front of computers at age two, the research even shows now that that is counterproductive to just about everything. And one thing we know about children, about humans, that we learn naturally. Everybody wants to learn. The idea of a human that doesn't want to learn, it's an oxymoron. And we've created oxymorons. That's a possible pun. In our educational system. I mean, we have children in our schools who don't want to learn. Well, who blame them? Being force-fed that unidimensional stuff in school and church and wherever, TVs. Okay, I better move on. Any questions about stage two? How do you grow a real adult? Stage two, you give them plenty of time in nature and way less time in schoolrooms. And as much practice of their imagination, of the four windows of knowing, I haven't mentioned that yet. The four windows of knowing, imagination, emotion, I mentioned those are two. The third one is sensing. And fourth is thinking. But allowing children to really think and think deeply, which we don't allow in mainstream education. We just train them to remember. But if you want a technologically advanced consumer society, you want to get rid of most of all that stuff. Okay, no questions, stage two? The four windows of knowing, which is A wonderful book by Steve Gallegos, G-A-L-L-E-G-O-S. Steve Gallegos. He says, he's the one who changed the Jungian thing just slightly. The words that Steve uses are sensing, feeling, thinking, and imagination. Imagination instead of intuition, because intuition can work through any of the windows. Okay, stage three, it usually starts around 13 or so. The transition between stage two and three is puberty, but not physiological puberty. That's not actually what's important at all to move to stage three. It's psycho-spiritual puberty. Well, it's really psychosocial puberty. In stage two, your center of gravity, okay, I'm going to move back a second. Stage one, the center of gravity, the hub of your life, is spirit. You haven't fully separated out from spirit in stage one, the nest. The hub of your life is still the great mystery. In stage two, your center of gravity has shifted from spirit to family and nature. Center of your life is mom and dad and brother and sister and the natural world. In stage three, your center of gravity now shifts to society, peer group, and sex, if you're healthy. Which is to say, if you're really in stage three.
Taking a step back, do you make a distinction between imagination and fantasy? Is that an important distinction?
The question is, distinction between imagination and fantasy. Depends what you mean by fantasy, but imagination has layers. The deep imagination is the kind that wells up from the depths and comes to us unbidden, like dreams. Fantasy can be directed by the ego or not, depending what you mean by fantasy. So the kind that's directed by the ego is shallow imagination, which is also very, very useful. But it's especially the deep imagination we want to encourage in our children. Okay, so stage three, there's a nature task and a culture task. And the nature task is to craft a personality, a way of social belonging that is authentic. Because your authenticity is what's natural about you. That's the nature task. And the culture task is to craft a personality, the same personality as the first one, that is socially acceptable. So it's really one task with two dimensions. The task is to craft a personality, to hone a personality that works. The nature task is that it needs to be an authentic personality, and the culture task is it needs to be socially acceptable. Either one of those tasks alone is really easy. Together, it is amazingly difficult, especially in a sick society. Let's take it one at a time. An authentic personality, no problem. I'll just get in touch with my emotions. Well, maybe it's a problem. If I can get in touch with my emotions and my values and my interests and my tolerances or intolerances, then I'll just act on those and the hell with everybody else. I don't care if they like it or not, I'll just do it. And if I do that, I'm going to be socially ostracized and I won't develop socially and I'll end up with all kinds of weird psychological symptoms and I probably won't get much further. Okay, what about the other side? Create a socially acceptable personality, which is the one that most people do in our society. Easy. I'll just pay attention to what other people want of me and I'll do that. No problem. And that's why we have so many conformists who never go wandering, never leave home in the middle of a wild night or any other night. So putting the two together, very challenging, the nature and the culture task of stage three, creating a personality, a social belongingness that is both authentic and socially acceptable. It's so hard to do in our society, the vast majority never succeed. And we have mostly conformists, including the rebels or conformist to their rebel group. But if you had to pick for your own child or grandchild, if you got to pick, which you don't, whether your grandchild or child is a rebel or a conformist, always encourage them to be the rebel. That's much better. Ideally, they don't have to do either, and they can just go off wandering. But if you have to pick, the rebel is much better, because they're already pushing away from the mainstream, which is sick, pathological in our society. If they were in a healthy society, rebel wouldn't be so good, but they wouldn't have to rebel if it was a healthy society. But every generation we can remember or know of, there's teenagers have their way of rebelling, and it's good. You know, when I was a teenager, we were hippies. Some of you were bohemians if you were older. Beatniks. And then since then, there's been punk and grunge and goth and I don't know whatever there is now. And it's all better than the alternative. Okay. Any questions on stage three? Oh, good. Why the thespian? Yeah, that's the archetype I had the hardest time finding. I used to call it the societal entrepreneur. Sounds. There's two problems with that. It's clunky, and the second one is masculine. The problem with that. So the thespian, because in stage three, we need to learn how to be dramatists, actors on the stage, the social stage. We do. It doesn't mean we're inauthentic. We're finding our authentic role in the social drama. It's not a deep thing. There's no great depth here. It's theater. And if you look at where the term thespian comes from in Greek myths and so on, it gets interesting, but I won't go into it now. But if you check it out, it's actually interesting. So, but thanks for asking, in part because in stage three, I think this is real important. Stage three is where the genders are most different. They're less differentiated in stage one and two than stage three, and they're less differentiated in stage four and after. Why are we so hung up about gender issues, partly for good reasons, in our society? We're a stage three society. We're an early adolescent society, and so we have this make this really big thing. Everybody gets up in arms about gender issues and sensitive new age men think they should become eco-feminists instead of men, mature men. Too many women, not the eco-feminists, but too many women think they should become female versions of men instead of mature women. So the genders are most different in stage three, and one of the tasks that begin in stage four, I'm getting ahead of myself, is that if we happen to be a very masculine person, whether we're female or male, doesn't matter, if we're a masculine person, we need to embrace our femininity in stage four if we're going to get much further. A mature person is balanced or working on balancing their femininity and masculinity. In stage three, it's too early really to do much of that. So we need to differentiate the thespian archetype into a masculine and a feminine version. And my masculine version is the societal entrepreneur. And the feminine version is the communal gatherer. Okay, so let me tell you what I understand masculine means and feminine means. And this will be a place to get into trouble. This is not about men and women. This is about masculine and feminine. Jungians know the difference there. Probably everyone does. For me, the masculine in both men and women wants to get someplace different than where it's at. Progress. I get a direction. I got someplace I'm going. I want to make things happen. Societal entrepreneur in stage three. That's not masculine in all the stages. That's masculine in stage three. Societal entrepreneur, making stuff happen. Let's get this team going here and this band and rock and roll and whatever it is. New ways of talking, dressing, dissing our parents, whatever it is. The feminine in both boys and girls, men and women, is not trying to get someplace else, but to further adorn and flesh out what already exists right here. The feminine is, what here is fabulous. Let's have even more of here. And the masculine is, I'm on my way somewhere, don't get in my way. Okay, how much trouble am I? Am I in trouble with that? And you'll talk to me later? Okay. Unfortunately, I have to whisk out of here right after the funny one. So to become an adult, which we really are training to do in stage 4, we need to balance out our masculine and feminine. Okay, so that's stage 3. Any other questions?
The feminine stage for the feminine side of stage 3, the gatherer in the community, the
communal gatherer?
Communal.
Yeah, so, you know, it's stage 3 is social. And so the feminine of the stage 3, which are usually the girls, most of the girls are in that place, they want, you know, get together with their buddies and find out what's here in our relationships and with their relationships with lovers of either gender. They want to know what's here. What's present now?
The oasis
part. Yeah, the oasis is right. The oasis is a social place. It's where people come and gather and get water and you know, what kind of music is happening here. Meet me at the oasis, Maria Maldir. Is that enough to explain that?
The nature task?
Well, no, the task is the authenticity, the authentic personality. The culture task is socially acceptable. And we need to do both. Social acceptability isn't particularly important after stage 3, but in stage 3, it is really and genuinely important. Backtrack a moment. In stage 2, children need to learn a value system, and they can't create one themselves. And so they need to learn their parents' value system. And if their parents are adults, it'll be a coherent, workable value system. But in stage 3, in that social, creating your own new social self, you got to create your own, you got to modify. You don't start from scratch, but you take your parents' value system and you modify it a little bit. But in our society, a lot of the parents have really warped value systems, and that makes it hard.
Just a question about the rebelling and the conforming. If the parents have not done the parenting in stage 2, are the adolescents going to rebel against the parents, or are they going to rebel against their own society that they find themselves in?
Both.
What will they rebel or conform to in stage 3 in our society?
Maybe I didn't understand your question, but I think they rebel against what you said. They rebel against their parents, and they rebel against mainstream society. And that's why you get all this, you know, the goth stuff and their own secret language.
But in their goth stuff and their own secret language, they're conforming to their own...
Yes.
It's age stage. They have a group of
conformists,
all with the tattoos.
Yes.
And, you know,
they're all conforming to each other totally.
They're conforming to each other.
And rebelling against their parents and mainstream society. See, there might be something else to say there. Oh, yes, there's this to say.
And they create their own culture.
Their own variation of a culture.
Yeah.
So if you're a parent of a...
They create their own culture.
Yes. If you're a parent of a teenager who's rebelling, the best thing to do is let them rebel. And the way... And because part of what they're doing is they're trying to push themselves into the world. If I'm trying to push myself into the world, and I need to go into the world, and as a teenager I do, notice that my parent, if I'm pushing against my parent, the best way my parent can help me is to stay still so I can push against him or her. So what does that mean? That when your teenager looks at you and tells you everything that's wrong with you and your way of life, you say to them something like, I'm really glad you're learning how to do it your way. And personally, if, assuming this is true, I'm sad that you don't like the way I've created my way of living. But I want you to know I feel good about it, and I feel really good that you're finding and exploring your own way. And that makes you something solid that they can push against so they can get out into the world. Does that make sense? Stand your ground and honor their ground. Both. It has to be both.
Do no harm. That's the problem.
Do what?
Do no harm.
Do no harm to yourself or others?
While they're rebelling, the difficulty
yes.
is you also have to send the message or have to send the message. Do no harm.
To others or yourself or both?
Both.
Yeah.
I think that's key. You don't.
Yeah. And if you
do. Talking about drugs, theft,
She's talking about drugs. She's talking about drugs. Hold on a second. Theft and violence and so forth. You think you can tell your kids not to do those things that'll make any difference? If they're going to be thieves, there were problems in stage one and stage two, and they need not lectures about not to be thieves, but they need help with their stage one and stage two tasks. That's one of the problems we have in psychotherapy and education now. We think we're supposed to find the, quote, bad things kids are into and get them to stop doing it. That doesn't help kids. They're doing those things because of developmental deficits. They don't know it's because of developmental deficits, and most of the teachers and parents don't know it's because of developmental deficits. But if I'm right, and if it is deficits, kids who are using drugs in a way that's abusive, and many uses of drugs are not abusive, but if they're using drugs abusively, which is probably the majority of teenagers now, they don't need lectures about drugs so much, maybe secondarily. They need help with the nature tasks of stage one, two, and three. And if you're just looking at drugs and just say no programs or whatever after-school non-drug programs, you're never going to get it. What's really important, I think. My opinion. Just like if you see a stage two kid who's obese, has diabetes, and has attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, none of those symptoms say, this kid needs to play outdoors. Think about it. Those symptoms don't say that at all. It says they need to be in a diet, they need insulin, and they need Ritalin. That's what they need. Well, I hope you agree with me. They don't need any of those things. They need to do their tasks, stage one and two. Okay,
yeah,
one
well,
last thing about drugs, okay. And then over to Lorraine. And that is, I'll save this because this is really about stage four, not stage three. Okay, over to Lorraine.
Isn't what I experienced is one of the problems in upper middle class children is their everything they do is okay. So they have nothing to push against. It's every time they try to rebel, well, that's okay. And they have this feeling. I mean, that's what I see. That's why they keep pushing the frontier all the way toward suicide or toward really scary things because their parents are almost too understanding. There's nothing to rebel against because their parents want to come along
yeah.
with them on the journey.
For good reason. Well, the problem starts in stage one. It's been, the seeds have been sown years before, in stage one. I have two maps, actually, in my book, and one is this map of soul-centric development, and the other one is called ego-centric development, which is what we have in our society, and it's too depressing to talk about in public. So I put it in the book, but here's one little piece, that what we tend to have in stage one in our society is not preserving innocence and creating viable egos. We have what I call basic obedience training and or basic entitlement training. And for liberal, progressive, upper middle class kids, it's often entitlement training. You'll have to wait for the book to read about entitlement training, but I bet you can figure out what it is. Nature and the human soul. it's been an hour and a half. We haven't had a break. And some, should we just have a minute bathroom break and then come right back and we're going to whisk through five stages in 30 minutes. Okay, here's a piece hanging from stage two, from the culture task. We don't do the culture task well. We don't even do the culture task well in stage two. The culture task is learning about cultural ways. So I'm just going to make this one sentence or two, that cosmology is so essential to the cultural learning of stage two. And it always has been for humans. Cosmology meaning, where are we from? What is this place we call the world or the universe? What is the story of the world? The cosmology is the story of the world. And we have something, we moderns, in the last 50 years or so, have something that humans never, ever have had before in the history of humanity. And that is, we have a story of the universe that is, you might say, empirical, scientific, that we actually have been able to see the beginning of the universe 14 billion years back. Thank you, Perry and Dirk, for the sidewalk. Brian Swim and Thomas Berry and others have been telling the universe story as a sacred story, which it is, and showing that there is absolutely no split at all between the sacred and science. That's one of the ways we duped ourselves, to think there was some kind of split there. The scientific-based story of the universe is a sacred story. And if anybody can't see miracles and a very deep imagination, a universe story, you're not looking very well. So stage two children need to be taught the universe story. And mythology. Mythology helps us understand what it is to be human. History tells us where our ancestors came from. Very different. All three of those are different. Mythology, history, and cosmology. Completely different realms. They're all important. Mythology and cosmology are left out of almost all second primary education now. Partly because, you know, mythology is for those pagans. Or history buffs. Okay, so I think we got through stage three, stage four. This transition to stage three to four is particularly important in our culture because that's the one that most people, more than 50%, in Western and Westernized cultures never make that jump to stage four. And the reason is because there's so many developmental deficits in stage one, two, and three. There's so many tasks, developmental tasks we've missed in stage one, two, and three, we just can't make the momentum. We don't have the momentum to get into stage four. But the way to get into stage four is to do stage three better. And one of the ways we do, one of the things we do in stage three is to work on stage one and two tasks we missed. That's all part of doing stage three better. But the most important thing in stage three is the stage three tasks. You don't get into stage four by doing stage four tasks. You can't do stage four tasks, because your center of gravity wouldn't allow you to do it. You could go through the motions, but it wouldn't be a stage four task. It'd be something else. So one of the principles, by the way, is the way to progress developmentally is to fall in love with the stage you're in. And I say that because some people will say, I'm just sick and tired of my stage. And I'll say, well, congratulations, you're stuck with it the rest of your life. You have to fall in love with the tasks of your stage and the gift of your stage. And then the irony is, once you fall in love with it, you get kicked out because you progressed. So stage four is where a healthy 15-year-old, just or 14 or 16 or 18, a healthy teenager at some point will start asking the stage four questions. They'll be on the threshold of stage four. Whether they get into it or not depends a lot on what kind of support they get. In a healthy nature-based culture, the elders are figuratively, they're standing on that stage 3-4 line that I've labeled confirmation. That's the passage, confirmation. The elders are standing on that line facing stage 3, and they're looking at the stage 3 kids, or older than kids, who are starting to ask the big questions, the questions of mystery, the spiritual questions. They're asking on their own, and they're wondering. They're wondering about romance. They're wondering, what is poetry really? And they want to change their consciousness. They want to alter their consciousness, because you cannot explore the mysteries of the world without altering your consciousness. So the healthy kids want to get high. Should I run out of the theater now? Or healthy kids want to get high. Unhealthy kids don't. Unhealthy kids get addicted to drugs or other things. Healthy kids do not get addicted, but they want to alter their consciousness. I've said that to roomfuls this size of high school teachers, and everybody was going, yeah. I couldn't believe it. I thought I was going to get arrested. Why aren't we? Yeah, there's all kinds of drugs, you know, plant allies are not the only way to alter our consciousness. My book, Soulcraft, lists about 40 ways to alter consciousness. Only one that only got a paragraph, so my publisher wouldn't get arrested, is on substances. But there's all kinds of ways to alter our consciousness. Sex is one way. That's another thing we tell teenagers not to do. Art. Expressive arts can do that. Body-centered practices of all kinds, including yoga, going for 30-mile runs, rock climbing, skydiving. Not too many are going to be skydiving, but simple things. All kinds of spiritual practices, whirling, dervish whirling. Never can think of all of them when I'm trying to. Fasting, drumming, rhythm, rock and roll, great way to alter consciousness. Everybody knows that. If you didn't, you need to go back to stage 3 and and have a rock and roll refresher. The Beatles. So stage 4, healthy stage 4 child, teenager, healthy stage 4 person of any age is going to be asking, okay, what's it all about? I'm quite convinced life isn't just about getting a job, making money, and buying stuff. It's got to be about more than that. So many teenagers, as far as they look at the older generation, as far as they can tell, life is only about getting a job, making money, and buying stuff. And a lot of those teenagers commit suicide. Who can blame them? There are no elders or initiators to tell them what the world's about. So when we look at the practices of nature-based people, we think they're barbaric. Okay, now let's make a comparison here. Maladoma Somei of the Dogara people in Africa, probably a lot of people know about Maladoma's work. His people, like a lot of nature-based people, initiate the boys at 13. I don't know about the girls, because Maladoma can't talk about the girls, because he's a man. But the boys, the girls are initiated in some other way, but the boys are initiated through some, what we would consider savage ceremonies, in which a certain percentage of the boys, 13, die. He doesn't tell us what percentage. I'm going to guess 1%, 2%. A couple of the boys in each group die. Now, that's uncivilized, we say. That's barbaric. The mothers and fathers of the Dogara people say, of course we don't want our boys to die. But there's one thing that's worse than them dying, and that's that they never grow up and become men. Compare it with our civilized society. I am convinced a larger percentage of our teenagers die. Suicide, armed services, aggressive cars, drug overdose, shootings, shot in school. A larger percentage of our children die, and almost none of them become men. Well, I said men just because I was using Maladoma's thing there about boys and becoming men. So we'd say a very, very small percentage of our teenagers become adults. A larger percentage of them die than in Dogara society. Who's more barbaric?